So thanks everyone for joining and welcome to The Sound of Economics. It's a great pleasure to be here and I'm absolutely thrilled to host today Geeta Gopinath, the chief economist of the International Monetary Fund and an outstanding academic. And I'm really pleased also, Geeta, because you are really at the forefront at the moment of thinking about and advising governments about what to do with the global economy and how to ensure that the recovery in the global economy from this huge pandemic is not uneven or is at least not quite as uneven as it might become. And so I really wanted to start discussing with you first about sort of the global outlook and then later on zoom in on a few specific issues, such as also the differences between the EU and the US recovery. But really, I wanted to start with the global issue. And of course, at the very end, we will have time for our guests on Clubhouse that can ask direct questions in this live and recorded Clubhouse podcast. So thanks a lot again for everyone joining. And thank you, Geeta, for taking the time. And really, I wanted to start and ask you to kick us off on where you see the global recovery really going and how even is it going to be? How much should we be worried about two-speed global recovery where the advanced economies roll ahead, also thanks to their more rapid vaccine rollout, while much of the global south lags severely behind on vaccines and might actually still have severe health issues in the next years and therefore less of a recovery?
Thank you, Gundram. It's a real pleasure to join you on the Clubhouse. This is a new platform for me, so this is exciting. In terms of the global outlook, we had our new projections. We put out our new projections in April. And, you know, in terms of the global recovery, of course, we see a rebound in this year. So after a historic contraction where growth was minus 3.3% last year, we are projecting global growth to be 6% this year and then moderating to 4.4% next year. Now, I think what's a very important feature of this recovery is the diverging prospects for different parts of the world. So we have some countries like the US and China that are recovering very fast, others recovering more slowly, and another set where prospects look much worse. And there are several reasons for it. There is the how the pandemic has hit the country. The differences in access to vaccinations are a very important factor. Those who have faster access to vaccinations are recovering faster. Countries that were able to provide a lot of policy support, fiscal measures, monetary policy measures, and so on, are also recovering much faster. Now, when we did our projections in April, you know, they get locked in sometime in March. And at that time, we had not yet seen India's second wave. So what we have to keep in mind is that these divergences we have projected were despite the fact that the pandemic, on average, until then, had hit the advanced world much harder than low and middle income countries. But I think what the India second wave episode is telling you is that this is not over. And we might be actually now seeing the worst prospect where indeed countries with weaker health systems actually get the full brunt of this pandemic. And so, for instance, I worry about the African continent in that regard, which also has escaped. So this is a very important, this is, you know, where a lot of my thinking is right now.
Yeah, I mean, let's zoom in a bit on the health issue, because I think I very much agree with you that the health issue is certainly a key driver for the recovery and the way these recoveries are shaping up. And we are seeing now, as you mentioned, a second wave in India. It's a massive wave. We have had daily cases of 400,000 new infections that were detected with tests, probably much more than that in reality. And you mentioned Africa, of course, and the African continent, certainly as a continent, has still extremely low vaccination rates. And finally, there's also Latin America, where, of course, vaccination in some countries has accelerated. For example, in Chile, it has been quite far ahead. But then it turns out that the Chinese vaccine that was given, administered, wasn't very effective against some of the mutations. including the P1 mutation coming from Brazil. So we have actually pretty dark overall global pandemic outlook, with global cases really still rising. And the pandemic clearly is not under control, and it doesn't look like it's going to get under control in 21. So how worried do we need to be really about this health situation? How do you see the situation?
Gundram, as you said, if you look at the numbers right now, global cases, despite the undercounting, is higher than it's ever been in any phase of this pandemic, right? And global daily deaths are still going up, and they're slightly below their previous peak, but in the next several weeks, they will be above that. So clearly, this pandemic is far from over. But to put some optimism in, I would say that we have a solution. We have the miracle of vaccines, the discovery of which went incredibly well. And so far, though we do have variations in efficacy, pretty much all of these vaccines still are quite effective in preventing serious disease and hospitalizations and deaths. So even if they might have much reduced efficacy with asymptomatic infections, but in terms of severity, I think they still do help. So what that tells you is that this is a solvable problem. I don't think the problem is, of course, that while we've had 1.1 billion and more vaccine doses provided to people, it's been entirely skewed and focused in some few parts of the world. So you have the US, which has over 40% that have got first doses, and you have the African continent, where about 1% have got first doses. Similarly, in India, only about 2% have been fully vaccinated. So again, for me, when I think about the solutions, the thing we have to keep in mind is that if you look at the supply that's in the pipeline in terms of vaccines from now until the end of this year, even if you adjust for risks of multiple kinds, you're looking at pretty large numbers, anywhere between, I would say, the pessimism, 6 billion doses, but you can get easily to 10 billion doses. So in that range, somewhere over there. So there are plenty of doses in the supply chain. The problem, of course, is in getting it equitably distributed to different parts of the world and to protect against downside risks, like some of the ones you mentioned, which is what if the whole set of viral vector vaccines become, people decide it's not something they want, or they can't use it because it's less effective. So those kinds of downside risks you have to prepare for. But again, it is a solvable problem, but just much more action is needed.
Yes, indeed. And if I can put on my hat as a member of the high-level independent panel on the financing for global pandemic preparedness and prevention and response that the Italian G20 presidency has put in place, I think one of the amazing things is that even in this huge pandemic that we are currently living in, first of all, the capacity to produce vaccines hasn't been ramped up quickly enough, but also the funding that was requested to get more vaccines more quickly being rolled out, especially in the developing countries, fell short and wasn't granted. So in the end, ACT A and other institutions did not get as much funding as they needed to, even though I think, as you rightly point out, by the end of the year, we probably have enough doses available so that this problem can be solved. But it needs funding, and it needs the willingness to export, and it needs the willingness to distribute this vaccine. So let me just ask you one short last question on the vaccines, which is on the trade implications, because I mean, part of the reason why it's not distributed is that it's very concentrated and that countries have imposed restrictions on exporting vaccines. The U.S. has run, since Trump, an America First policy. Others have similar policies. The European Union is actually doing fairly well. It's exporting half of the domestically produced vaccines. But what can be done to improve the exports of vaccines? And what can be done to increase production capacity? Should intellectual property rights be waived with a TRIPS agreement? I mean, where do you fall in this debate?
Again, I think there are lots of lessons that we are learning from this pandemic and things that we will have to do a whole lot better in preparation for future events of this kind. So my responses will be more in terms of, given where we are now and given that what we need is to expeditiously end this pandemic in all countries so that we return to normalcy in all countries as opposed to just a few, what is needed? And the way I see it is that in terms of manufacturing capacity, and so therefore what's in the pipeline, between now until the end of this year, there are a large number of doses. So again, like I said, according to the Pharmacy Manufacturing Associations, it's about 10 billion doses. I mean, by the way, that is a risk-adjusted number. The actual numbers are even bigger than that. You can shave off a few billion doses, but still that is a large number of doses. Given where we are in terms of the calendar year between now and the end of this year, and the time that it takes up to actually have a fresh new capacity come in, it takes time. It takes 3 months to 6 months to 9 months. So I would say that in terms of the priority is one, realizing all these vaccine supplies that are supposed to come through so that they actually happen. That requires indeed making sure that you have free flowing raw materials and finished vaccines so that you take export controls off. I feel optimistic that with every month that will get better, because especially in the next month or so, you will find the US and in a couple of months, EU will be well ahead in terms of getting as many shots in arm as they can. Supply will probably be in excess of demand. So I think these restrictions will come off much faster. The second thing is also what's needed is vaccine donations. And this is not about what you can do in the future, but you can do it now. There are places in the world, including the US, where already supply is in excess of demand in the sense that there are doses that are sitting in storage plants. You can estimate almost 750 billion vaccine courses that can be donated just in 2021. That's another one. And the third is, I would say that you need to put in at-risk investment to ensure that if a bunch of downside risks realize, and that would include, say, some plants having problems, raw material shortages arising, certain vaccines, people don't want to use it either because they hesitate to use it or because they're less effective. So putting at-risk investment in place to kind of insure yourself against that possibility are the steps that have to be taken. And the point I would make here in terms of, you know, vaccine donation is that even if you believe that your priority is your own country, if you set a goal like saying 75% of your population has to be vaccinated before we give it out, by the summer, we're already talking about hundreds of millions that are available to share. And it's very important to share that, not by political considerations or commercial considerations, but by epidemic considerations, by public health considerations, by equity considerations. And that is a very important part. So again, I think that there is a lot that's coming out in the next couple of months, in the next few months, that what we can do better, but it cannot be business as usual as where we are now.
Well, thanks a lot. I think that's already quite a note of optimism. But let's perhaps move on and go back to our original topic, which was really the uneven recovery, and look at the global north. So not the difference between the north and the south, but let's say the difference between the United States, perhaps the UK, and the European Union. What's your take on the speed of the recovery? Your own projections show that Europe will reach pre-pandemic levels quite a bit later than the US. And, you know, what is driving these differences?
If you look at the advanced world, even within that group, you have different speeds of recoveries, with the US coming back much faster this year, back to pre-pandemic levels, and next year surpassing where it would have been in the absence of the pandemic. And you have the EU also coming back, but at a slower pace with a lag of few to several months, depending upon the country you're talking about. So if I were to say what exactly is the main factor that I would think drives the different recoveries, again, all of this has to do with the pandemic. So in terms of the reaction of economic activity to the pandemic, that gets affected because of containment measures that are mandated. But it also gets affected because of behavioral responses that are different across countries, and also because of the kinds of sectors you have. So when you look at the EU and the euro area, for instance, you see that even when cases were going up very similarly in the US and in the euro area and in the EU more generally, activity held up much better in the US than it did in the EU and the euro area. And you can see that in terms of first quarter numbers. You've had strong positive growth in the US, while you've had recessions, with the exception of, you know, France, which has had a mild expansion in the euro area. And so this is a consequence of the fact that, yes, the strictness of containment measures varied, but also kind of the de facto impact in terms of behavioral responses was much more severe. And you can see that in service sector activity. You know, services sector continues to expand strongly in the US while it still is having a difficult time in Europe. So that's a big part of the story. And of course, the vaccination efforts have been ahead by a few months in the US relative to those parts of the world. And that's another reason why it's kind of coming through slowly.
The health situation, of course, one important driver and very important for the service sector, very important also for the recovery differences across the Eurozone or the EU, where countries that rely on tourism probably will see a much slower recovery because the health situation prevents that sector from recovering. But let me ask you on fiscal policy, because there's a lot of talk and a lot of discussion about the differences in the fiscal policy response between the EU and the US. And if you look at European Central Bank estimates, they suggest that last year, fiscal support by the US has been significantly higher than that of the euro area. So now with the Biden administration, we get a massive package and we might get even another one, which is even bigger. And now the big fear is that it might even be too much and actually be quite inflationary. But in any case, it's a sort of what some commentators call a high pressure economy. So an economy that is really pressured by very expansionary fiscal policies. While in the EU, the tradition has been to be a little bit, let's say, less expansionary, even though the EU has done a lot fiscally, I have to say. I mean, the member states as well as the EU with its own recovery pact. So where do you fall in this debate? I mean, how important has been the fiscal response for the differences in the recovery speed?
So, Gundram, I echo your point that a lot has been done in the EU on the fiscal front, both by countries and at the EU-wide level. So the EU Recovery Fund being a very important part of that. So I would say a lot has been done. Now, indeed, the US put in this additional $1.9 trillion package, and that adds a boost to the recovery in the near term for the US. But if I were to point to where I think the big differences are between the US and the EU, I would say the pandemic, the health, the behavioral responses, the sectoral composition with the greater reliance on tourism, I would say those factors are very important. So we should expect to see a strong recovery in the second half of this year for the EU as vaccinations pick up and catch up with the US. But yes, the US does get an extra boost from the package that's been put in place and the $1.9 trillion package. But again, I don't think that that's necessary for the EU. I think all countries in the world should, of course, you know, keep in mind that this pandemic is not over and there could be another round of spending that may be needed and they should be careful about that and make sure that they don't prematurely withdraw support. But I think a lot has already been done.
Thanks. I mean, I want to soon turn to the audience, but let me ask you one last question before we take questions from the audience, which is really on what used to be called a taper tantrum. So a premature tightening of monetary policy with negative effects on financial markets, perhaps even financial stability implications, and perhaps even a broader macroeconomic implications. Now, I have to ask you that because yesterday, I think Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen was on the record saying that, you know, we might have to see earlier increases in the rates, and that led to a certain sell-off technology stocks. So what's your advice on monetary policy on both sides of the Atlantic?
So this is a pretty tricky communication period, I would say, for most.
That's why I'm asking you.
Most senior officials of the US administration and the Federal Reserve. So my view is the following, which is in terms of inflationary pressures, I would say that, you know, we could certainly see some transitory increase in inflation. So in this sense, I guess I share the Fed's view that there will be a transitory uptick. There could be a transitory uptick and quite likely will be also because there's mechanical kind of computational features. But the question is whether is this going to translate into persistent overshooting of the Fed target and going well past what the Fed wants to attain, which is this average inflation of 2%. At this point, I believe that that is less likely to be the case. Such kind of persistent overshooting is less likely to be the case. For an important reason that, you know, the $1.9 trillion package, while large, is still temporary and it's transitory. The supply side bottlenecks that we are seeing that would also put pressure on prices is also transitory in nature. In the second half of this year, it should smooth out. The concern for me would be if there were new spending packages that were announced that were unfunded, that gave you the expectation that this was a deficit finance increase in spending for multiple years. And that's what happened back in the 1960s. It was that shift in expectations that a lot of people attribute to inflation going from around 2% to 6%. So when it comes to these newer packages, at least everything that's been announced so far signals that it will be financed through increasing revenues. And I think that is an important part of the design of the package, that to prevent further overheating and de-anchoring of inflation expectations. I guess that's the one metric I would follow very closely, is to see what's happening with long-term inflation expectations. And so far, regardless of which measure you use, it seems well-behaved. And again, you do want to attain the Fed's average inflation target.
Wonderful. Giuseppe, let's bring in some questions from our audience.
Yes, thank you very much, Guntram. I'm going to open for questions here. We are not going to have an enormous amount of time, but we hope to have enough time to have quite a few interesting remarks. So I have already someone lined up over there. We have a few actually Bruegel scholars, and I would like to see the deputy director of Bruegel, Maria De Mertzis, who would like to take the floor. Maria, please, the mic is yours.
Yeah, thank you very much, Giuseppe, Guntram also, and Gita, thanks very much for your very thoughtful remarks. I wanted to perhaps ask what may be perceived as a premature question, to the extent that we can think about a post-pandemic era, maybe not soon, but there will be a time, there will be a post-pandemic era. I wonder what kind of structural changes, structural shifts we can envisage. And I'm talking about economic issues primarily. And what I have in mind as a very interesting question in this respect is the issue of productivity. Do you think that the changes that we're seeing right now are going to generate a post-pandemic boost productivity? Or do you think it will be exactly the opposite? There's a very interesting discussions going on in this respect, and your thoughts on this would be really helpful. Thank you.
Hi, Maria. Good to hear you, and if I can see you. In terms of your question about what we might expect in terms of productivity growth in the post-pandemic scenario. So firstly, I would say it's early days to be completely sure, but I see a few patterns that I want to point out. One, of course, is on the positive side, we've seen a whole lot of innovation that's happened in terms of remote working, in terms of a lot of services that used to be done in person being done remotely, like e-medicine, for example. And so this pandemic accelerated a lot of technology adoption in different countries and in different companies around the world. And so that has the benefit of, you know, increasing productivity. It's basically making a technology that was more narrowly used, making it more general purpose, and that tends to have a positive effect on productivity. But on the other hand, this is a crisis that has accelerated the shift towards automation. So automation was a trend that preceded this crisis, but we're seeing increasing automation that will likely happen after this pandemic. And we know that with automation comes the need to reallocate workers, and you find a problem with mismatch in terms of skills people have relative to what is actually needed. And so you need to have retraining, reskilling, and that the mismatch has to be solved. Now, what we've seen again historically in the past is that when you have this kind of a mismatch, this process of reallocation takes time. And that, again, reduces aggregate productivity in the economy, even if you attain the same level of labor supply, right? And so that goes in the opposite direction. But these are challenges that, of course, countries need to address as they come out of the pandemic. A third, of course, is that we haven't seen in major solvencies in many parts of the world. In fact, solvency rates have been lower in this pandemic than they were before because of the extraordinary measures that were put in place, including moratoria on loan payments. Now, when that is taken off, we are likely to see, and we have research on that, that there will be several, especially small and medium enterprises, that are likely to go into insolvency, putting 1 in 10 jobs at risk. So again, that can have a negative effect. And of course, I would mention productivity. This is even more long-term. But I worry about the hit to human capital that has come from lost education in many parts of the world, and especially in the developing world, which of course affects productivity. So I don't have a where this all adds up to answer, but again, these are certain channels we're exploring and looking at.
Thank you so much, Geeta. I would like to give the floor to Rebecca.
Hi, thanks so much for doing this podcast with us. It's really interesting. I wanted to ask about the IMF's role in the climate transition in terms of how it affects market access for a lot of these countries. A good IMF sustainability or report or economic forecast can really affect whether they can borrow on the bond markets. We know that the climate transition will have some short-term costs that could make debt go up and growth go down. So how can the IMF make sure that accurately assessing those doesn't also cut countries off from the financing they need to go through with it?
Very interesting question. So there are a couple of points that you made, which is one, that there are countries, our members, who are being hit by climate change. They face the brunt of climate change. They're seeing natural climate-related disasters happen all the time, and that's affecting their potential income, their possibilities to repay. Then there is a second piece, which is, given that mitigating climate change is so macro-critical, that it is important for countries to be investing in mitigating climate change and also, of course, adapting to climate change. And then there is the question of, well, that usually can be very costly because you will have energy sectors, if you're an energy exporter, that affects your potential income. If you work in a fossil fuel sector, then that hits your livelihoods. If you consume energy and if carbon taxes are put, prices could go up, that could affect you. So, you know, these are obviously all very, very important issues. And we have done a lot of work exactly on trying to make this transition happen without being costly in the sense of countries basically ending up with losing millions of jobs and losing market access. So it's very, very important how you design climate policies in your countries. And so, for instance, we emphasize that you want to do a comprehensive strategy, which involves one, public investment in climate infrastructure, and R&D subsidies to increase new kinds of technology, storage, and so on. And then the second piece is to have a predictable, gradual increase in carbon pricing. We think that's very important to get the incentives right and actually attain the climate mitigation goals. Otherwise, we think it's implausible without it. And then the last piece, to make it a just transition, which means that to use for the carbon revenue that's being raised to compensate those who face higher energy costs, who are vulnerable, poorer households who face higher energy prices, and also for those who need to transition away from fossil fuel sectors to the greener sectors. And if you do this package, in our calculations, the overall hit to GDP in the near term is, in fact, if anything, in terms of jobs created, can be positive over the next 10 years. And of course, by preventing catastrophic risk to the planet, you end up with just much higher productivity and growth in the way out in the long run. So this is exactly right. And so it is very important to manage this transition carefully. We're doing a lot more work at the IMF in terms of evaluating financial risks from climate change, from just measurement issues, so that there is consistency in how people report what they're doing on the climate front. We're pushing for minimum carbon tax floors. So there's a lot that we are doing on this front on climate change. This is a very big issue that we're dealing with at the IMF.
Thank you, Geeta, for this. And next person online is Sri. I would like to ask you to take the mic and perhaps say your name and present yourself as well.
Hi, Bruegel. Thanks for bringing me up here. My name is Sri. I come from India. Hi, Geeta. First, I would like to tell that you're a big inspiration for me, especially for all the young women in India, to see you come from such humble backgrounds to achieve this great thing. Thanks a lot. The thing I wanted to ask is, like, I come from a small state called Tamil Nadu, which has a lot of these welfare economics, right, which gives a lot of impact to all the weaker section of society. Especially in this pandemic hit season, like, there's always a constant debate of how much one should spend, the state should spend, and how much should they not spend. So I'm just wondering, like, how does one draw a line? Because especially like in Tamil Nadu, where there's a economically weaker section of the people are more, they expect a lot from the state, right? So how does one balance this?
Hi, Sri. Thank you for your question and also for your kind words. You know, again, how much should a country spend depend, or a state like Tamil Nadu spend, depends on the details of the state in terms of the different education, skill levels, the kinds of sectors that exist and so on. But the way I think about it is, I think it is the government's responsibility to provide certain public goods. And of course, besides the standard, you know, law and order and so on, education and health are two essential public goods that the government should provide. And should be made available universally to everybody. So that those are essential spending. So this comes in the category of the government ensuring that everybody has the opportunity to realize their potential. I also think that the government should provide a basic social safety net to ensure that everybody has a minimum livelihood that they can maintain. And especially in times like this, when you had the pandemic and people were forced to stay home, or they were told to leave jobs, and they then meant, you know, hundreds of kilometers they had to move to their villages. I think it's very important to make sure that all of these people get cash in kind and food. This is not just the rural workers, but including the urban poor and the migrants. And so, again, it's essential for the government to provide access to opportunity for everybody. It's not just the poor, but also prevent discrimination of any kind, and women's issues are top on that front. And of course, to ensure that, especially in this pandemic, people are being hit because of a completely exogenous episode, something they have no control over, that you have to make sure that they have the health care, get the health care they need, and they get incomes needed to maintain basic livelihoods and to tide over this period.
Thank you so much. I still have one other person in the audience who would like to ask a question. Mariana, please, the mic is yours, and introduce yourself as well.
Thank you so much. And this is definitely a pleasure. I'm a big fan of Geeta and the work that she has made. I am the Minister Counselor for Economic Affairs of the Costa Rican Embassy here in DC. I'm an expert in trade and international finance, but above all, I'm a single mom. And as a single mother, I understand the gender component of the impact of the pandemic, especially in a region like the one that I come from in Latin America. So I would like to know if there has been any initiative to support governments to gather more specific data on the impact of the pandemic. For example, I belong to this group of trade experts. We are all female, all related to trade. Some of them work at ITC in Geneva. And they have been really clear with me when I have tried to pose some gender-related questions that there's not enough data to be able to know what's happening. Thank you.
If I heard you right, Mariana, I think you were asking about gender-based data. Yes, absolutely. This is a major issue, and it is a problem. Not just in Latin America, but in many parts of the world, that we just don't have the facts in terms of how, you know, women are affected, how, you know, what's happening. Just gender-based collection of statistics will give governments a lot more information that they need to address the gaps in access that to opportunities that women have relative to what men have, including in terms of entrepreneurship and financing and so on. So that's a big part of it. And I would say that the related step, of course, is gender budgeting. That is that when you have this information, you make sure that your budgets are walking the talk in terms of making sure that this access is available. And this pandemic has hit women so hard, you know, disproportionately hard relative to men in many parts of the world, not just because they tend to work more in contact intensive sectors, but also when it comes to child rearing and childcare, when schools shut down, it's still women who do the bulk of the caring. And so we certainly don't want to reverse the progress that has been made over the past decades in bringing women into the labor force, raising labor force participation rates. So that has to be absolutely addressed. And again, you can't do that if you don't have the data. So you absolutely need to be collecting data that identifies also by, you know, by gender.
So thank you so much. I'll give back the floor to Guntram, and thank you so much to the listeners that actively participated so far.
Yeah, no, I think our time is up, and Geeta, I really want to thank you. And I have to say, I also want to thank the audience, because it was an absolutely thrilling experience, I have to say, to finally have an event again with a real audience that can ask questions. And on top of it, it's a global audience. So we have heard from people in India, in Europe, in Latin America, in the US. So I think this is really an amazing global experience, and shows also the power of technology in perhaps also overcoming some of the differences that we are observing. And so it's also opportunity what we are seeing here. But I think it was extremely insightful discussing various aspects of the uneven recovery. Geeta, do you have a last comment or remark before we close?
I just want to say thank you, and indeed to everybody who joined this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Geeta.